Making water or mud had always been an irritating challenge for her. She cannot simply retreat behind a tree as the others might, not for the sake of modesty, a sentiment that would have been pummeled from her in childhood, but out of a keen awareness of men and their lustful infirmities. She had to plunge deeper, beyond the possibility of craning looks. "A glimpse is a promise," the brothel masters used to say. "Show them what they would steal, and they will spend. Spend!" She squats, her breeches crowded about her knees, stares up into the veined complexities of the canopy as she relieves herself. She follows the dark lines of silhouetted limbs scrawling across foliated stages, ragged screens set across ragged screen, each brighter than the next. She doesn't see the figure. Not at first. But then its shape is unmistakable. Human limbs clutched and hanging about arboreal. Unlike other forests, where trees branch and thicken according to their exposure to the sun, the trees of the mop fork into low nethers, as though begrudging all open space. The creature hangs from the lowermost skein, unnaturally still, intent with scrutiny and malice. The thing called Soma. Her fear falls short of reason. If it had wanted to kill her, she would already be dead. If it had wanted to steal her, she would already be missing. No, it wants something. She should cry out, she knows, send it fleeing into the sepulchral depths, chased by the crack and thunder of sorcerous lights. But she does not. It wants something, and she needs to know what. Slowly, deliberately, she stands and draws up her leggings, winces at her own humid reek. Its face hangs down just far enough to be discernible in the murk. Soma, as if glimpsed through a veil of black gauze. The canopy's high-hanging glow paints his edges with traceries of green.
"He's killing you," it coos. "The non-man."
She stares up, breathes, immobile. She knows this thing, she reminds herself. Knows it as surely as scalpers know shrank. Assassins. Deceivers. Sowers of resentment and mistrust. Discord arouses them. Violence spills their cup. They are, as her mother once told her, the consummate union of viciousness and grace. "Then I shall kill him first," she says, shocked by the resolute tenor of her voice. Her whole life has been surprised by her ability to appear strong. This is not the reply it was expecting. She's not sure how she knows this. It's hesitation, perhaps. Or the click of indecision that passes like smoke across its false expression. Regardless, she knows that it does not want the non-man dead. At least not yet.
"No," it whispers. "Such a thing is beyond your power."
"My father—"
"He, too, would certainly perish."
She glares upward, peering, trying to discern the folding digits that compose its face. She cannot.
"There is only one way to save yourself,"
it rasps. "And how is that?"
"Kill the captain."
She rejoins the company as if nothing has happened. She should tell Akamian. She knows this without wanting to know. Her reflex is to hide and to hoard, a product of the brothel, no doubt. Too much had been stolen.
"Soma came to me."
She circles this thought, stalks it, returns to it the way she continually reaches for her kore where it hangs about her neck. As troubled as she is, as frightened as she is, a part of her soul exults, in the mystery of it, certainly, but also because it had chosen her before any of the others. Why had it saved her during the stone hag attack, at the cost of revealing itself no less? Why was it following them in the first place? And why was it reaching out to her? After the nightmare of Maymore, Akamian spent long miles verbally pondering the skin spy and its presence among the skin eaters. From the outset, he made assumptions, forgivable assumptions, that the skin spy had infiltrated the skin eaters immediately after he had contracted them, that he, the outcast inheritor of their ancient and implacable enemy, Seswatha, was the motive for the infiltration, that it was charged with killing him, lest he discover something too decisive, and so on. More than anything else, what prevents her from telling the old wizard is the fear that he is wrong, utterly and catastrophically. The suspicion that the consult has sent the skin spy not to assassinate Akamian or to sabotage the expedition, no. Her fear is that the consult has sent it to assist them, to ensure they reach Sogleesh and the coffers. And why not, when Drusus Akamian is the enemy of their enemy? According to her mother, the consult waited months before finally attacking Kellis during the First Holy War. "The only thing they found more terrifying than your stepfather," she said, "was the possibility there could be more like him. The possibility of Ishwal. The origin of the Aspect Emperor. As much as Akamian desires this knowledge to judge Anna Sarimber Kellis, would not the unholy consult covet it even more?" She had seen the wizard with the judging eye, seen his damnation. At the same time, she simply assumed that sorcery was the cause, that contrary to her stepfather's claims, sorcery remained the unpardonable sin. And this seemed to lend credence to Akamian and his desperate case against the man who had stolen his wife. But what if this wasn't the case? What if this very quest was the ground of his damnation? There is poetry in the notion, as perverse as it is. And this, more than anything else, is what hones her fear to a cutting edge. To strike out in the name of love, only to inadvertently unleash the greatest terror the world has ever seen. When she mulls the possibility, it seems to smell of the whore through and through, at least from what she has seen of her. This is what makes telling the wizard all but impossible. What was she supposed to say? That his life and the lives of all those his deceptions have killed have been in vain? That he is a tool of the very apocalypse he hopes to prevent? No, she will not speak what cannot be heard. Soma would have to remain her secret, at least for the immediate future. She needs to discover more before going to the wizard.
Kill the captain.
She knows this creature. She can number the bones in its false face. She even knows the questions that will confuse it, hint at the absence that is its soul. It stands upon a different field of battle, vast and spectral, and devious with a thousand years of patient calculation, and for some reason it needs Lord Cossiter to be a casualty of that cryptic battle.
Kill the captain.
Understand this command, she realizes, and she will understand Soma's design. She has watched the slow transformation of loyalties and rivalries within the company. She has seen the glint of sedition in Galien's eyes. She has noticed the way Akamian has come to accept, even prize, the captain and his ruthless methods. Lord Cossiter will deliver them to the Library of Sogleesh, despite all the perils and uncertainties. He is simply one of those men, possessed of a will so cruel, so domineering, that the world could not but yield. He was the captain, the harsh shadow, bloodthirsty and pitiless, forever standing in her periphery. She has always watched, and her eyes are nothing if not critical, but she has never probed, never tested. According to Soma, something was happening, something that would eventually imperil their lives. According to Soma, things transpired that neither she nor the old wizard could see. So she will squint against the glare of the obvious, peer into the gloom of implication. She will pretend to sleep while pondering possibilities and assembling questions. She will solve this one mystery. she will become a spy. So far, the mop has climbed and conquered every terrain they have encountered, scaffolding the sides of hills, braiding the heights above rivers, pillaring broad plains. She has peered through the green murk and trod across root-heaved earth for so long that sometimes she forgets the arid smell of open places, the flash of sunlight, and the kiss of unobstructed wind. All is humid and enclosed. She feels like a mole, forever racing beneath the thatch, always wary of flying shadows. When she thinks of the stone hags who have fallen in exhaustion, they are already buried in her soul's eye. Finally, they come to a stone formation, jutting like a great fractured bone from the earth. Scrub clings to its scarp shelves, but nothing else, and peering up, they actually catch ragged glimpses of sky where its bulk breaches the canopy. Standing aloof from their curious peering, the captain bids them to find a way to the summit. Though hours of daylight remain, they will camp. The sun glares, the air chills. The mop tosses on, an endless ocean of swaying crowns. Whatever relief they hope to find in wind and sunlight is snuffed when they look to one another. Squinting, eyes glittering from blackened faces, ragged like beggars. In the gloom below, they seem as true to their surroundings as the moss or the humus. Here on the heights, there is no overlooking either their straits or their desperation. They look like the damned, Akamian in particular, given the mark. They make camp on the formation's rump, where enough soil has accumulated to sustain a thin wig of foliage. They sit in scattered clots, watching the setting sun fall crimson into distant canopies. The mop seems to mock and to beckon in turn, a susurrus, unlike any she has heard, a horde of a million, million leaves rattling in the dying breeze. Opposite their camp, the formation rears onto a promontory, stone horned like a bent-back thumb. The captain stands in the dying light, beckons Cleric to follow him. Maimara pretends not to watch them vanish about the treacherous ledges. She counts 50 heartbeats, then strikes out along the opposite face, where they have designated their latrine. She continues past the putrid smell, literally risks life and limb scaling a serrated pitch. Then she creeps forward in a crouch, moving toward the sound of muttered voices. The breeze, or the play of echoes across chaotic stone, fools her, for she almost blunders upon them. Only some instinct to freeze saves her from discovery. She breathlessly shrinks behind the cover of a tortoise-humped outcropping. "They remind you," the captain's voice. It shocks her as surely as a knife point pressed against the back of her neck. She creeps along the outer circuit of the tortoise stone, nearer, nearer. As shallow as it is, her breath burns against the tightness of her high chest. Her heart thumps. "What's happening?" the nonman says. I don't understand." "You are truly a blasted idiot." She steps from behind the rising shell of rock, finds herself standing almost entirely exposed. Only the direction of their gazes prevents them from seeing her. Cleric sits in a pose of dejected glory, at once beautiful and grotesque, for the blasted depths of his mark. The captain stands over him, a vision of archaic savagery, his core so close to the nonman that she can see a faint husk of salt rising across his scalp. "Tell me," Incario cries in hushed tones, "tell me why I'm here." A moment of glaring impatience. "Because they remind you." "But who?" "They remind me of who?" Even as Cleric says this, his glittering black eyes wander toward her. "Someone you once knew," the captain grates. "They remind you of someone you once—" He whirls toward her. His hair swings in broken sheets of black and gray. "What are you doing?" he barks.
I, she stammers. "I think I need more Kiri."
A moment of murderous deliberation. Then, something like a grin hooks his eyes. He turns wordlessly to the non-man, who remains seated as before.
"No," Cleric says, with a strange solemnity. "Not yet. I apologize, my Mara."
This is the first time he has spoken her name. She retreats, flinching from the captain's manic glare, her skin buzzing with the shame of her exposure. Afterwards, she remembers the non-man's lips more than his voice, their fulsome curves, white-tinged with too long in the water blue. She sees them moving to the rhythm of consonant and vowel.
"My Mara."
Like a kiss, she thinks, her arms bundled against a curious sense of chill. Like a kiss. She keeps to herself the following day. The wizard seems only too happy to oblige her. The trail has its rhythms, its own ebb and flow. Sometimes everyone seems to be engaged in low conversation, while other times everyone appears sullen and wary, or simply lost in their own laboring breaths, and naught can be heard above the whistling chorus of birdsong. Their descent back into the mop has replaced their anxiousness with melancholy. She is quite lost in thought when Cleric comes alongside her. Senseless ruminations, more a collage of recriminations and pained memories than anything meaningful. She smiles at her shock. The unearthly beauty of his face and form unsettles her, almost as much as the horrid depth of his mark. Something wrenches at the inner corners of her eyes whenever she allows her gaze to linger. He is contradiction incarnate.
"Is it true," he inexplicably asks, "that being touched by another and touching oneself are quite distinct sensations for men?"
The question bewilders and embarrasses her, to the point of drawing even more heat to her flushed face.
"Yes, I suppose."
He walks in silence for a time, eyes tracking the ground before his booted feet. There is something overwhelming about his stature. The other men, with the possible exception of Sorrow, exude the same aura of physical strength and martial brutality as had so many warlike men on the Endymion Heights. But Cleric possesses a density beyond intimations of force and threat, one that reminds her of her stepfather, and the way the world always seemed to bow about his passage. She thinks of all the skinnies he has killed, the legions incinerated in the existential thunder of his voice, and he seems hardened for the multitudes that flicker shrieking before her soul's eye, in Kilauges, on Maemor, across the mop, as if murder draws flesh to stone. She wonders what it would be like dying beneath his black, glittering eyes.
"Beautiful," she decides.
"I think I once knew this," he finally says. At first she cannot identify the passion twining through his voice. Akamian has told her much about the non-men, how their souls often move in ways counter to the tracks of human passion. She wants to say sorrow, but it seems more, somehow. She wonders if tragedy could be a passion.
"Now you know it again," she says, smiling at the frigid gaze.
"No," he replies. "Never again."
"Then why ask?"
"There is comfort in rehearsing the dead motions of the past." She finds herself nodding, as if they were peers discussing common knowledge.
"We are alike in this way."
"My Mara," he says, his tone is so simple with astonishment that for an instant he seems a mortal man.
"Your name is my Mara."
He turns to her, his eyes brimming with human joy. She shudders at the glimpse of his fused teeth. There is something too dark about his smile. Ages have passed, he says, wondering, since I have remembered a human name. My Mara. Afterward, her thoughts racing, she ponders the absurdity of memory, the fact that so simple a faculty can make a being so powerful, so pathetic in its faltering. But the wizard has been watching, of course. He's always watching, it seems. Always worried. Always trying. Like mother. What did he want? He rasps in heated Einani. Why do you fear him? She snaps in return. She is never sure where this instinct comes from, knowing how to throw men on their heels. The wizard walks and scowls, frail against a murky background of colossal trunks and moss deadfalls. Trees growing in a graveyard of trees. Because I am not sure that I could kill him when the time comes, he finally says. He speaks as much to the matted ground as to her, his beard crowded against his breastbone, his eyes unfocused in the manner of men making two honest admissions. When the time comes, she says in mocking repetition. He turns to her profile, studies her. He's an erratic, my Mara. When he decides he loves us, he will try to kill us. The words she overheard the previous night seem to clutch with their own fingers, to scratch with nails like quills. But who? They remind me of who? Someone, the captain replies in his grinding voice. You once knew. She composes her face into the semblance of boredom.
How can you be so sure?
She asks the wizard. Because that is what erratics do. Kill those they love. She holds his gaze for an instant, then looks down to her trudging feet. She glimpses the skull of some animal, a fox perhaps, jutting from the humus.
To remember?
She doesn't mean this as a question, and apparently understanding the old wizard says nothing in reply. He always seems preternaturally wise when he does this.
But his memory, she says.
How could he be more powerful than you when he can barely follow the passage of days? Akamian scratches his chin through the wiry mat of his beard. There's more than one kind of memory. It's events and individuals he forgets, mostly. Skills are different. They don't pile on the same way across the ages. But like I told you, sorcery depends on the purity of the meanings. What makes magic so difficult for you to learn turns on the same principle that makes him so powerful. Even if he has forgotten the bulk of what he once knew. 10,000 years, my Mara. The purity that escapes you, the purity that I find such toil, is simply a reflex for the likes of him. He stares at her the way he always does when trying to press home some crucial point. His lips slightly parted, his eyes beseeching beneath the furrowed brow.
Akuya mage, she says.
Akuya mage, he repeats, nodding in relief. Few things in this world are more formidable. She tries to smile at him, but looks away because of the sudden threat of tears. Worry and fear assail her. Over cleric and the captain, over the skin spy and what it has insinuated. She draws a deep breath, risks looking at the old man. He grins in melancholy reassurance, and suddenly it all seems manageable, standing here at his gruff and tender side. Akka, the world's only sorcerer without a school. The only wizard.
Akka, she murmurs. A kind of gentle beseeching.
She understands now why her mother still loves him, even after so many years, even after sharing her bed with a living god. The uniform teeth behind his smile, the sheen of compassion that softens even his most hostile glare, the heart and simple passion of a man who, despite all his failings, was capable of risking everything, life and world, in the name of love. What? he asks, his voice querulous, his eyes twinkling. An unaccountable shyness climbs into her face. He is, she realizes, the first man to have ever made her feel safe.
May our dooms be won, she says with a curt nod.
The old wizard smiles. May our dooms be won, my Mara. The pebble it throws is round and chipped, drawn down from the high mountains, its surface cracked and polished by ages of blasting water and migrating gravel. It threads the sieve of dead branches, climbing its low-thrown arc, before sailing into the midst of supine company, over the slumbering form of Pacuas, into the tangle of hair about her head. She awakens instantly, knows instantly. Soma. She recoils from the thought, knowing that Soma, the real Soma, lies dead somewhere near Mero. That what awaits her in the black has no name, because it has no soul. She wanders from the camp, following a rare lane of low light, beyond the first ring of towering sentinels, beyond the reach of any incipient wards. She feels more than sees the shadow atop the blunt limb above her. Breathless, she looks up. The shadow leans down and forward, and she sees it, staring at her with wide, expectant eyes. Her own face.
I can smell the fetus within you, she hears her voice say. Kill the captain, and it will be saved.
No, no, no. Deceit, devilry and deceit. All her life she has thought in whispers, a habit of slaves, who must practice within what will save them without. But her heart shouts as she tries to find her way back to sleep. Lie. This is what they do, skin spies. Uncertainty is their contagion. Fear and confusion are their disease.
They seduce, her mother once told her. They play on your fears, your vulnerabilities. Use them to craft you into their tool.
But what if? Coupling. It was something she did. A kind of blankness rose within her, an absence where human feelings should have been. Men always wanted her, and she almost always despised them for it. Almost always. Sometimes when she needed things, or she simply wanted to feel dead, her body answered their want, and she took them into her. She held them while they labored and trembled. She bore them as a burden upon her back. And she almost never thought about it afterward. Simply continued running through her running life. She has endured innumerable suitors, while on the Andiamene Heights, an insufferable parade of dandies and widowers, some cruel, others despondent, all of them hungry for the peach of imperial power. To a man she had spurned them, had even managed to provoke a handful of former protestations. One, the Patrodomas of House Israti, even brought a suit before the judges, claiming that she should be forced to marry him as punishment for her slander. Mother had seen to that fool. But she had been bedded nonetheless, and despite years of carrying a whore shell, despite the chaos of her menstrual cycle, pregnancy was not impossible. The strong seed forces the womb. Her mother was proof of that. Three, she tells herself. There are only three occasions she can think of that would make the accursed creature true. There was the darling body slave, little more than a boy, who attended to her ledgers before her flight. As absurd as it is, she owns estates across the three seas, as does everyone in the imperial family. There was Imhalus, the vain captain of the Eothic Guard, who helped her escape in exchange for a taste of her peach. Then there was Acamion, who yearned so for the mother she so resembled. She had yielded, and he had taken, their first mistake together, he had called it, in exchange for a sorcery she no longer desired. Three, she tells herself, when in fact there is only one.
She dwells on the skin spy and its revelation, makes adversaries of its words and an arena of her soul.
I can smell the fetus within you.
She battles it with unvoiced denunciations. Liar, she rails within. Obscene deceiver. But hers is a treacherous heart, forever miring what should be simple with unwanted implications. So she hears the wizard speaking in rejoinder. The judging eye is the eye of the unborn, trying to explain away the horror of her accursed sight. The eye that watches from the vantage of God. On and on the voices tangle, until it seems they are one and the same, the sorcerer and the spy.
Kill the captain, and it will be saved.
No, she tells herself. No, no, no. The brothel has taught her the power of pretense, the way facts will sometimes fade into oblivion if you deny them with enough ferocity. This is what she will do. Yes. 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 Several days pass without sign of the thing called Soma. She tells herself she is relieved, yet she lingers in the lonely dark nonetheless, gazing up through the dead branches, listening to the blackness croak and creak. One night she finds a small pool bathed in a miraculous shaft of moonlight. She crouches beside it, stares up through the hanging tunnel to consider the moon. She gazes at her image poised between floating leaves and finds herself troubled. The skin spy, she realizes, was the last time she saw her own face. She wants to fret over her appearance in the old way, to primp and preen. But it all seems so foolish, life before this, the slog of slogs. Then, in the empty interval between breaths, the judging eye opens. For a time she gazes in stupefaction. Then she weeps at the transformation, her hair cropped penitent short, her clothing fine but with the smell of borrowed things, her belly low and heavy with child, and a halo about her head, bright and silver, and so very holy. The encircling waters darken for its glow. She convulses about breathless, sobs, falls, clutching her knees for anguish, for she sees that she is good. And this she cannot bear. The old wizard pesters her with questions when he returns. He wonders at her swollen eyes, worries. She withdraws the way she always withdraws when dismay overwhelms her ability to think clearly. She can see the hurt and the confusion in the wizard's eyes. She knows that he has treasured the gradual intimacy that has grown between them, that he's truly come to think of her as his daughter. But this can never be, for fathers do not lie with their daughters. So she spurns him, even as she allows him to curl about her, to shelter. Weeks pass, weeks of marching gloom and touches of Kiri. Weeks of battling clans of Shrank. Weeks of tracing the line of her stomach in the murk. At last they walk clear of the mop, and it seems like climbing, setting foot on land open to the sun. They gather in a line across a low ridge, 13 of them including the hags, their skin and clothes black from sleeping across mossy earth, the splint and chain links of their armor, rusted for rain, and torn for battling Shrank. The skin-eaters remain intact, but the hags have dwindled to 3. The Tidoni Thane, Herm, who remains as hale as any, the Galeoth Freeman, Cole, whose body seems to be wasting about his will, and the deranged Corinian, Helicus, or Grinner, as Galeon calls him, who seems to draw sustenance from madness. The ground collapses into broad skirts of rock and gravel below the company's feet. A smattering of trees cling to the base, hedged by surging nettles and sumac, a tangle of stem and color that abruptly ends in blue-green swathes of reed, a kind of papyrus,
hazy miles cut by black water channels. Salt marshes. The Karish Sea forms a featureless plate across the northern horizon, iron dark, save where the sun silvers its faraway swells. They watch ripples of lighter green sweep over the marshes, the apparition of the wind across the rushes. And then they see it, the bones of once mighty walls, the scapular remains of a gate, and the fields beyond clotted with ruins. She gazes in silent wonder, watches a shadow of a cloud soundlessly soak the distances gray and blue. "Behold," the old wizard calls out from her side, "ancient Kelmeol, home of the sons of Maori, the far antique capital of these wastes ere the first apocalypse." She gazes at him, unaware of the palm that has strayed to her belly.
"Your father..."
She bites her lip, hard, as proof against getting sick. A Kalmian could scarce believe his fortune, until sighting Camille. He had not realized just how little he had believed in his own mission. Ever since Marrow, some seditious faction within his soul had doubted he would survive even this far, and it seemed a kind of miracle that men could suffer such trials in the absence of belief, that deeds worthy of wonder and song could be accomplished on the strength of a doubting will. Unable to find the causeway, the company waded through the mire, beset by clouds of mosquitoes and biting flies. Several actually cried out in relief when they finally clambered onto hard ground and into the wind. After a mere watch, Sarl looked poxed. He was covered with so many welts. Kelmeol lay before them, the terrain humped with tells, the grasses so high it seemed a field in Mascentia, save for the grand remains of towers and temples breaching the near distance. A Kamian had wandered the ruins of antique cities before, but never one so vast or so old. Siswatha had come to Kelmeol in 2150, one more refugee of the fall of the high Nocerai nations. And though those dreamed glimpses were 2,000 years old, a Kamian could not shake the sense that Kelmeol had fallen in his lifetime, that he was witness to a miraculous obliteration. With every glance, a part of him wanted to cry out in disbelief. There, where the mighty twin statues of Ol-Yanau had looked down the processional, and out across the harbor and over the turquoise sea. Later he would find one of the great heads staring out of the high grasses, more than half buried, and yet still taller than a man. The harbor itself had been swallowed by waving miles of reeds, its very shape lost to the creep of earth and ages. There, where the hull, the whitewashed curtain walls, had traced the circuit of the city. In some places nothing more than a berm remained of the once celebrated fortifications, whereas in others sections remained remarkably intact, missing only the polished bronze spikes that had once adorned the crenellations. There, where the ponderous lines of the Nosk mausoleum had loomed over the lesser structures of the Pau, below Harbor District, a place of drawn blades and bared breasts, he could still see the rear walls of the Nosk rising like a husk from the ruins of the façade, the stone black, save where matted with white and green lichens. The Pau, however, had utterly vanished beneath the waving sheets of green. And there, the Hylor, the sacred acropolis where the three auguries once read the future in the blood of stags, rising like a low-hewn tree stump against the blue band of the Karish Sea. The citadel had been raised to its foundations, the palace where Siswatha had taken refuge from the whirlwind was little more than a mouth of ruined teeth behind the marbled pillared porticos. The decision was made to camp on the ruined acropolis, where they could defend against whatever shrank clans ranged the marshes. In the mop they had slogged in a loose file. Now they spread out across fields, walked in a ragged rank. They opened and closed about fragments of structure and ornamentation, heaps of spilled masonry,
and square columns fallen for so long that the ground had climbed to encompass all but their leaning grounds. In some places, the ruins crowded thick enough to break their formation altogether. A sadness welled through the old wizard as he walked and peered, a mourning that possessed the airy clutch of premonition. There was poetry in loss and ruin, a wisdom that even children and idiots understood. For a time he suffered the eerie sense that he walked one of the great capitals of the Three Seas, that these were the ruins of Momin, Carathuzel, or Invishi, and that they were the last men, 13 instead of 144,000 of legend, and that no matter how far they traveled, how many horizons they outran, all they would find was soot and broken stone. The world became strange with loneliness, and quiet, very quiet. Insects whirred to and fro, fluff scribbled across the back of warring gusts. Without thinking, he reached out for Maimara's hand. He did not answer her wondering gaze. By happenstance, he found himself abreast Galien and one of the remaining stone hags, the dispossessed Tidoni Thane, to Borsa Herm. Herm was perhaps the strangest of the stone hags, both in appearance and behavior. He continued to shave, for one, long after even Galien had abandoned his bare chin. At the close of the day's march, when his brothers could scarce speak for exhaustion, he would set to sharpening his dagger, which he had worn as narrow as a fish knife, for use on his cheeks at first light. Apparently this was a kind of ritual protest among the ordinarily long-bearded Tidoni, a way to proclaim the theft of one's honor. Either way, it spoke to the man's stamina. Even without Kiri, he seemed to have little difficulty matching the company's pace. He had one of those lean physiques, with powerful shoulders perpetually angled forward, as if in anticipation of a sprint. His face, which remained ruddy even in the perpetual gloom of the mop, was shaped like the outward curve of a bow, with close-set eyes and a tiny, even womanish mouth, beneath a shark-fin nose. Galien was pressing the man with questions about the stone hags and the scalpers they robbed and murdered, an indelicate topic, even given the crude standards of the slog. "Gaily," Akamian heard Paquas murmur in warning. The former columnary scowled up at the towering Zayumi. "I want to know what moves a man to kill his own kind when skinnies are stacked to the horizon."
"Scalps," Herm said, grinning. "The custom house counts. It makes no distinction between the likes of you and the likes of me."
"I don't understand," Galien said, his voice lowered in mock caution. Somewhere, somehow, Akamian realized with more than a little dismay, the man had lost his fear of their captain. "The bounty is the holy bounty, is it not?"
"Holy, is it? What else would it be?"
A phlegmatic snort.
"Gold," Herm said after spitting a string of phlegm. "Gold for mead, gold for pork and onion stew."
His porcine gaze clicked from place to place, then settled on Maimara, appraised her with a kind of milky viciousness. His lips parsed about rotted teeth.
"Gold for pretty, pretty peaches."
Perhaps this was when Akamian first sensed the madness about to happen.
"You would wage a damnation for these things?" Galien asked. "Damnation?"
A sly grin.
"The holy bounty is holy because it has been decreed by the Aspect Emperor."
"The Aspect Emperor, is it? Would you like to know what I think of our glorious tyrant?" Akamian recognized the triumph in the columnary's look. Galien used the same baiting manner with Soma, only with more mischief than malice in his eyes.
"Very much."
What was happening here? The Tidoni Thane grinned with alehouse cruelty.
"I think his gold was born to burden my purse. I think he overlooks the likes of me, and of you. I think all those prayers, all those little wire circumfixes, are naught but wasted effort. Because in the end," he continued with a conspiratorial lean, "I think he's no different than you or me. A sinner, a dog, a demon when too deep in his cups.
a fool.
A fraud, a scalper of so— Lord Cossiter materialized at the man's side, his knife out. A Commian blinked in confusion. A stabbing motion. Herm crushed his cheek against his shoulder, as if plagued by a mosquito in his ear. Maimara cried out for shock. A Commian stood dumbfounded. Gripping a nest of black hair, the captain, impossibly, held the man upright while he hacked at the man's neck with his free hand. For an instant there was no blood. Then it seemed to gush from the jerking form. "Blasphemer!" Sarl chortled, his teeth and gums shining, his eyes squeezed into creases. "No blasphemers on the slog!" Galien hadn't known this would happen, the old wizard realized. The captain continued his savage work, grimacing in yellow-toothed disgust. He did not so much cut the head from the body as hack the body from under the head. The hag's black-stained limbs flumped senseless between the grasses. His head yanked high like a freed kite. "Anna Sarimbakellus," the captain raved at the survivors. "He is the god, and this—" He swung Herm's head so that the blood flew from the crimson lobes of its mouth. "Is his work." A Commian could only watch with detached wonder, the kind that afflicts the survivors of sudden catastrophes. He saw well enough. He knew well enough. And yet none of it made the slightest sense. He found himself wondering how long before Cleric called on them to dispense the Curie. He needed it. To the point of wringing hands and clenched teeth, he needed it. The captain, it seemed, was a believer. Zaldunyani. The pretense of thought twined through the fraud that was its soul. It ran like a dog, bent, so that the grasses whipped in wet shags about its face and shoulders. The morning sun hung low, a pale orb in the mists that always greeted the dawn on the shore of a great sea. Gold limned any stonework bared to the sky. The Acropolis rose from the ink of its own shadow, a silhouette without depth in the haze. There was beauty in the destruction, as well as thunderous proof of the old fathers and their power. Here the will and might of men had perished before the rapacious hunger of the derived. Here the glorious multitudes had coupled with the screaming, the broken, and the dead. These were holy facts, sacred. But the thing called Soma did not raise its head to contemplate or to consider. It did not dare. There was the tracker, Zongus, whose almond eyes missed little. And there was the non-man, whose senses almost rivaled his own in some respects. There was the mission. It paused over the headless corpse of the stone hag, listened to the music of carrion flies. It lingered for a moment, long enough to savor the thickness between its thighs, the arcing bloat. Then it continued racing along the company's blundering trail. On the heights of what had once been called the Hylor, it dashed through concentric shells of ruin, crept through debris-choked foundations. It ignored the vista, the cities scattered like bones, the steaming marshes, the plate of the Karish Sea. Instead, it rooted through the remains of the scalper camp, sniffing the sweet where their anuses had pressed against the grasses. It found the spot where the female had made water, only to flee from the reek of her fetus. It paused over the sour musk of the non-man. Something was happening, something unanticipated by the old fathers. It cringed, swatted its face in slouching fear. Had anyone happened upon it at that moment, they would have seen a crazed creature, limbed like a man but possessing a woman's beautiful face, greased with blood and filth, rocking from foot to foot like a bereaved ape. It bent back its head until the base of its skull pressed against the crown of its spine, unsheathed its second voice, and screamed. "There is no need," a small voice piped from above.
I have followed you since sunrise.
It whirled in feral alarm. A series of ruined walls fenced the ground behind, each rising and falling like miniature mountain ranges. A bird perched on the summit of the nearest, its body glossy black, shot with strains of violet, its head white with marmoreal translucence. And human. A synthase, vessel of the old fathers. Flowering weeds trembled in the wind besides its clicking feet. A daylight moon, pale as a blind cat's eye, rose above its obsidian back. The thing called Soma fell to its false face.
"You were to watch him," the bird said, a miniature scowl creasing its expression.
"Things have changed." Eyes like blue beads closed, then opened.
"How so?"
The thing called Soma dared raise Maimara's face.
"A sorcerer, a Gnostic sorcerer, hired the company several weeks ago. He hopes to find the coffers."
A moment of palm-sized confusion.
"The Mandate? The Mandate has hired the Skin-Eaters?"
"No, I'm not sure. He claims to be a wizard, a sorcerer, without a school. Even still, Chigra burns strong in him. Very strong."
The synthase bent its tiny head down in momentary meditation.
"So the old fool has found his way back to the Benjuka plate. And he discovered you? Drusus, a Commian?"
"No. There's a woman with him. One who has been taught how to recognize us. A pregnant woman."
A sharp puppet nod.
"The face you wear, I see."
Shadows fluttered around the bird form, as if some greater eye blinked about the world. An intimation of rage and power.
"Maimara."
The thing called Soma cringed and retreated.
"Yes."
"She's pregnant. You are certain of this?"
"The stench is unmistakable."
Another moment of bird hesitation, as if each thought had to be untangled. It was no small matter planting a soul so mighty in a skull the size of an eggshell.
"Then she cannot be harmed. All the prophecies must be respected. The false as much as the true."
"Yes, old father. I anticipated this, which is why I refrained."
A sideways twitch of the head. "She leaves the safety of the others?"
"To piss and shit. I have spoken with her twice now. She will yield their secret in time."
"And the schoolman has not intervened?"
"He does not know."
The small head flicked back. Laughter tinkled like glass. The consult synthase looked from the high lore, its gaze ticking between points across the fields of papyrus, out to the featureless reaches of the Karish Sea. The wind combed its feathered tailings, blowing wide with the inaudible roar of absence and ruin. The thing called Soma breathed deep the scent of ash become earth.
"Brave girl,"
the old father cooed, still considering the crumbs of the age-long feast that was the Maeorn Empire.
"Continue tracking them, Suor. At the very least, they will take you home."